Welcome to Inclusion Bites, your sanctuary for bold conversations that spark change. I'm Joanne Lockwood, your guide on this journey of exploration into the heart of inclusion, belonging, and societal transformation. Ever wondered what it truly takes to create a world where everyone not only belongs, but thrives? You're not alone. Join me as we uncover the unseen, challenge the status quo, and share stories that resonate deep within. Ready to dive in? Whether you're sipping your morning coffee or winding down after a long day, let's connect, reflect, and inspire action together. Don't forget, you can be part of the conversation too. Reach out to joe.lockwood@seechangehappen.co.uk to share your insights or to join me on the show. So adjust your earbuds and settle in. It's time to ignite the spark of inclusion with Inclusion Bites. And today is episode 164 with the title, Harnessing Humanity for Success. And I have the absolute honour and privilege to welcome Bhavesh Naik. Bhavesh is a business performance and longevity expert who helps leaders build thriving, resilient organisations by embracing the humanness of their people. And when I asked Bhavesh to describe his superpower, he said that it is that he brings a deeply realised sense of self-awareness, leadership and organisational success. Hello Bhavesh, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Joanne, for having me.
Glad to be here. So you're based in Washington, is it, if I remember rightly?
I'm outside Washington, D.C., about 10 miles northwest. So I'm in Montgomery County for those who might be familiar with the area here.
Fantastic.
So outside of D.C.
What's it like out there at the moment? So we're in February, aren't we? Is it cold? Have you get icy breezes?
It gets cold, yes. Right now, today is probably 20 degrees Fahrenheit, and I don't know what that translates into in centigrade. That is definitely below zero, but it might be like 5, 10 degrees below zero. And that's pretty normal for us this time of the year. So it's, winter is about to be over, hopefully, but it's cold. But luckily, we used to have some storms, like really bad snowstorms 5 years, 10 years ago, but we haven't had those for a while. So that's some good news. And I don't know if that's a good news or bad news, because I don't know.
Yeah. It's just cold. There's no strong winds and pouring with rain and snow. It's just cold.
Yeah. That's true. Yeah. It's just cold.
A bit like going skiing. It's just cold. It's not. It's nice sun, but cold.
Exactly. Yeah. Cold. Yeah.
As we were saying, when I read out the introduction just now, you believe in self-awareness, and you know, I'm a great believer in emotional intelligence and being self-aware. So, how does that manifest itself for you in high-performing workplaces, or what got you into the work you're doing now?
Yeah, so self-awareness, and if I can go back a little bit. So self-awareness to me is, first of all, it's just terminology we use. It's not even a belief to me. It is an experience of being in a certain way, if that makes sense. So self-awareness. So if someone Googled self-awareness, right? There will be a definition that Google spits out, which would be some version of, okay, being aware of your strengths and weaknesses. Now, that's a very intellectualized version of that. I don't know where that comes from. But when I talk about self-awareness to me is more of the classic definition, or more of a common sense, the literal definition of self-awareness, which is self-aware, awareness of the self. So self is here, this person right here speaking to you, and being aware of this person and all his surroundings, right? So, and I like to do this a bit of an experiment, and I want to do this with you if you're game, Joanne. Can we do that a little bit?
Yeah, right? Let's go for it. Yeah.
So, just to kind of prove a point, I like to show rather than tell, because you can use a lot of words, but when you get so, and our listeners can follow along with us. Here I am talking to you. This is my perspective. This person right here, right? And I have my internal experience, right? My thoughts and feelings and all of those things. And then I have my senses, right? So I'm interacting with the outside. So there's sounds and, you know, sights and, you know, pictures and all the other senses, like we have 5 senses. So there's this person talking to you, and then there is you. So there is your perspective. You're talking from there, or you're seeing out from that side, right? Now, for both of us, there is also, if you know, we have this ability as humans to be able to see ourselves doing whatever it is that we're doing. So we can bring an awareness to this person. It's almost like you're coming out of the body and looking at ourselves, but not looking at ourselves, just feeling ourselves.
So like playing a video game where you're controlling your first person shooter. You're controlling your character on the screen from above rather than being through the eyes. You're
exactly
an aerial view.
Yeah. Now, experientially, do you feel that a little bit?
Yeah, sometimes. Yeah.
So it's in this moment, right here, right now. So we're having this conversation, right?
Yeah.
So I'm speaking to you, and yet there is a faculty here that allows me to observe me speaking to you, having this interaction with you.
Yeah, I can snap my mind into that. Yeah, it's not default. Yeah,
Default. Yes.
Yeah,
but you can get into that. And did you get into it?
Yeah. I can see myself in the corner of the room over there and see me at the desk. I can do that. Yeah.
Okay, right. So, and you're using the intellect a little bit, and it's even easier than that, or it's even simpler than that. But we can't do it because we've been trained not to do it. The children are very much like that, right? When they're toddlers, they are living that state. And then our intellect pulls us out of it. So that is the self-awareness that I'm speaking of. And when I talk about self-awareness, the realized sense of self-awareness, and that's a key word, right? It's not just intellectualized sense of self-awareness. It's just being here and experiencing it here. And I'm here most of the time, just observing whatever this person is doing, right? Now I go in and out of it, but I'm probably there 60, 70% of the time when I'm awake. And that's a wonderful way of being, because we can talk about that if you want, but that is an important thing for me to talk about, because that is an agent through which in my work, I think transformation can happen within organization, within teams, within ourselves.
I'm just trying to create a metaphor for my own thinking. So what we're really doing is, by stepping back and observing ourselves, we're taking a additional level of responsibility for the actions you're taking, because you're observing those actions in real time, not just being in the action.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. Sometimes we talk about this gap between an action and reaction. So something happens and we react to it, right? So that gap between something happening and we reacting, that gap, you can call that self-awareness, right? So yeah, exactly what you're saying. I'm kind of saying the same thing in a different, slightly different way. And that is a very powerful way of being. And there are other connotations of that. You know, for example, that's a very happy place. That's where happiness is, because this is why children are so happy most of the time, right?
Okay, yeah.
Yeah.
I think I'm more aware of that modality of thinking when I'm planning or imagining what I'm doing tomorrow, or if I'm trying to sequence a project or an outcome. I'll be thinking of me as an avatar, a computer game, navigating the world. And I'm saying, okay, so I'm going to get on the train. I'll see myself getting on the train and I'll be interacting with people. I'll be having conversations.
Right.
So I suppose more in the future tense, I'm planning my life and my next, what I'm doing through that remote control avatar, if you like.
Sure.
Probably less so in the moment.
Okay. Yeah. I get that. Yeah. And doing it in the moment is, it takes a little bit of practice, but if you come to it again and again and again, it you may feel a certain sense of like relaxation. So another way of looking at this is being in the zone, being in the flow. So when people who play sports, right? When they get into the zone, and when they're into the zone, they're not processing, they're not strategizing, they're not planning, they're not thinking. They're just doing what they need to do. Now there is an aspect of skill. You know, they've developed certain skills, right? But they're not thinking about, okay, you know, if I'm shooting a basketball, right? They're not thinking, they're not strategizing. They're just doing it, right? So that makes them, because if I am strategizing in that moment, if I am practicing, right, then I'm not as effective as I would be if I was just being in the moment. Yeah. And so
you're going into automatic mode. It's when you develop a new skill, from my understanding, is that you would, first of all, you'd be very conscious of what you were trying to do.
Right.
And then you end up with a dip in performance.
All right.
And then you break through that and then you become better because it becomes embedded in your subconscious. It becomes
automatic. Sure. Absolutely. Yeah.
Like driving a car. How often do you come home from work and you don't realize how you got home? You think, did I stop at that red light? Did I see that red light? You must have done because you're not conscious about that journey, are you?
Exactly. Exactly. And that's an excellent example, driving, because that's a skill that most of us have really mastered. So once you master a skill, then you go into a zone. Sometimes it's called the state of being in a flow, right? Where the activity is happening and your mind is engaged. And because your mind is engaged, this person here can just kind of step back and do other things. Now, we tend to do a lot of thinking because we are thinking people and we have been trained to think all the time. But if you can let that thinking quiet down a little bit, you can just be present. You can just be in that moment, right? So like it's right this moment, right? So if I asked you this question, Joanne, are you aware?
Right now, no.
Right.
But so when you say right now, no, right? But there was a pause. I said, are you aware?
I had to test myself and evaluate in my head whether I was or wasn't and came to the conclusion, no, I'm in the moment right now because I'm focused on the conversation.
Yeah.
What we're going to talk about next, the flow of the podcast. I'm more in active thinking about what we're doing mode rather than observing, if you like.
Let me ask you a different way. Are you conscious right now? Because you weren't when you were sleeping at night.
I'm awake. I'm conscious. I've got decision-making power. Yeah.
Right. So then if I ask you again this question, pause for a bit. Are you conscious?
Yeah, I am conscious. Yeah.
Okay. So you went to some place before answering that question. Are you conscious? You went to that place called consciousness. That's an experiential thing. It's not intellectual. So there's a gap there that you went to. And then you said, yes, I'm conscious. That is the awareness. So it's a different name for it, awareness or consciousness. That's the consciousness.
Okay.
And it's beyond. The reason why I'm kind of getting a little bit down into this is because this is key. It is so central to everything that I talk about in my work with organizations and people and teams and things like that. So this is the agent. It's beyond intellect. It's outside of intellect and processing.
Okay, so we've got the multi-state of mindsets. We've got, as you say, we've got the self-aware, looking down on you, able to influence the world around and direct you in different directions. You've got the heavily engaged in autonomous mode where we're just doing what we do.
Right.
How can we use those different states to our advantage then?
Right. It depends on which situation we're talking about, right? So for example, there's an aspect of this called the situational awareness, which is if I'm just walking down the street, just kind of being aware of my surroundings. That's one kind of awareness, right? So it gives me safety. It allows me to feel, you know, out and, you know, be aware of things that may be not quite right around me. And then I would make a notice of that. And then I would act appropriately. Maybe I change my direction, go someplace else. Or if it happens to be a friend who is approaching me, then I would walk up to that person and say hello, things like that. So that's one example. But then depending on different situations, this can become a handy tool. So like for, you know, we talked about sports. Being in a meeting, being in a sales call, being in negotiations, being talking to a manager, talking to an employee, having a team meeting, having workshops, what we're having right now for this conversation right now. I think that conversations like this become more powerful when we play from this, because what needs to come out, what needs to happen in this moment, the right words. And we've been in that zone. I'm sure you've been in that zone because you do this a lot, right? Where right questions just come out of the moment and say, aha, let me ask him this, right? So, and that's a very effective way of just being.
So let me just try and explain the metaphor that's going around in my head. So we have, I think you used the word agents earlier.
Yes.
So we've got, and maybe even I'll bring another word in, sensors. Yeah, mm-hmm. We've got these agents and sensors. You know, you talked about your threat analysis sensor, and you've got some bit of your brain that's checking in on that sensor occasionally. We've got another one that's checking in on the conversation sensor ahead of us. We're having a communication with somebody, or we've got our hunger sensor or our sense of direction. So we've got our brain is going around all these different inputs to our
sure.
ourselves.
Sure.
And generally we're not aware of them. But what you're saying is we're trying to become more aware
exactly.
of these specific interactions we're having with the world.
Yeah.
And not just treating them as in the flow. Yeah, you know, we're being exactly. aware rather than just being in the flow.
Yes. Yeah. Right. There is this term called neuro-linguistic programming. I'm sure you've heard of that term, right?
NLP. NLP. I've heard the term, yeah.
I have a bit of a take on that, right? An interpretation of that. I like that term, and it means certain things to certain people, right? You know, there are practitioners of NLP. But if you break down that term, neuro-linguistic programming, right? So neuro is neural network, right? We are receiving bits and bytes of information. Right, into this instrument, right? And we happen to have five senses, right? So from the external sources. And then the linguistic, so we call it the linguistic part is the labels. So basically language is a series of labels. So we have thoughts, conceptualization, and we have labels and ideas. And those are connected together, right? Words, sentences, paragraphs. So with those, we attach meaning to what's happening. So all these inputs coming in, because the input coming in is just bits and bytes of information. We're using computer terminology, right? So, by the way, we have an aside. Computer was actually made after people looked at the human body. So computer is the replica or a copy of what humans can do, right? But now we live in computers. You know, we live in this age where we're so surrounded by them that we look at them as a way to look at ourselves. So anyway, bits and bytes of information, linguistic, right? So language. So that gives it meaning. So if there is a loud sound coming from that corner over there, right? You know, all of a sudden, I would basically look at that because there is some circuitry here that attached a meaning to that, right? That there's a thread there. And I looked up, right? So that is the linguistic portion of that. And programming is I react like that in that fraction of a second because I'm programmed to do it. So that's the neuro-linguistic programming. So that's one way of looking at it. This self-awareness, I happen to see that self-awareness in seven dimensions. So, we talked about in the introduction, we talked about being human, right? Now, so the one question that often comes up is, what does it mean to be human? And we have basically said for ages that being human means being rational. This is how we are different from the animals. We're rational people. Animals don't have that rational capacity. And that's true. Chimpanzees and some of the other things that on other animals, they do. But there is some truth to that. But what I like to say is that, and I think this has been talked about before, where it's the awareness, the fact that we are aware of this person, me being me, us being able to look at ourselves as a third party. Our language is like that. There's a word called I and there's a word called me. I is me, the subjective person. Me, this happened to me as like a third party. So that's like an object in a way, right? So what makes us human actually is our self-awareness. As far as we know,
sentient,
yes.
Cause and effect, seeing your reflection, knowing it's you, how you interact in the world. That's
right.
Kind of all that stuff that separates us from beings that aren't self-aware. Yeah,
exactly. And that's what allows us to even teach children something. We know. I don't know if you in England you say this rhyme. Head and shoulder, knees and toes. Right. So a child is growing up and we kind of say, well, this is right. Exactly. So if the child was on self-aware, we wouldn't be able to teach them this, right? Because we're bringing their awareness to themselves. We're teaching them self-awareness. They're already self-aware, but we're kind of bringing the linguistic and rational aspect to that. So being human, self-awareness is what makes us human. And I look at that awareness manifesting in 7 different ways. So, and another important thing, this is also how we are different from AI or artificial intelligence or general AGI, artificial general intelligence. So, and this is important to kind of understand. I watch a lot of YouTube videos by very smart people, but they don't talk about this. They're saying that, okay, you know, computers are becoming very smart and we are programming, we're doing this data modeling and, you know, we are collecting all of this information and retraining our models to think. They're not really thinking. They're just processing data, right? The meaning is given by us because we are the ones with the self-awareness. So ChatGPT is going to put some things together, right? But it doesn't understand the meaning of it. It's the reader who's reading it who's going to bring meaning to it. Right? And that's the definition of being a human. So there's some hope for us. The machines are really not going to take over. They could, but they're programmed, only if they're programmed to do
it. Isn't the difference, really, even though quantum computing, all these computing advances we've had over the last 100 years, whatever it may be, the difference really is our brain is just a better computer at certain tasks.
Yeah.
AI, quantum computing, whatever we want to talk about, that the machine computers are really good at ones and zeros and sequencing and those sort of things. What they're not trained on is, as you say, sentience. Our brain is just a more evolved bit of flesh that enables us to be specialists in that area, which is why we're not all good at mathematics in our head, but a computer is. So different things. So could AI, machine-based computers, eventually develop matrices like our brains? What's to stop them?
Yeah, that's a good question. So if I go back a little bit, so have you ever dealt with, there's a problem that you're trying to work out in your head, right? And you can't figure it out and you went for a walk and you were engaged doing something else or you're just walking or doing something else and all of a sudden the solution drops in your head. Has that ever happened?
Oh, it happens all the time. Right? I trust my brain to do that. Sometimes I will deliberately, if I can't find something, I need to solve something. I know if I put it on a shelf in my head, I'll wake up one day or something will happen. I go, got it. There it is. And I don't sweat it. So I know, I trust my brain to solve that equation at some point if I leave it on the back burner.
Yeah. So I want to go back and preface something. Everything that I propose is for examination. So no belief system here. Right. So I would highly encourage people to, you know, listeners to take what I'm saying for checking. Don't buy what I'm saying as a belief system or a dogma. Right. This guy's saying it, so it must be true. Don't do that. So with that, I would say that the brain. Right. So then this goes into some pretty fundamental existential questions. Right. If the brain is wired that way to get these answers, who did it, right? This is a very fundamental question. And, right, we don't have the answer to that. So,
I'm an evolutionist, so I guess as an evolutionist, a Darwinist, I would say it evolved in that way.
So that is a creationist theory. And I'm not opposing the theory within certain contexts. That is true. And at the same time, you always ask this question, the origin question, which is, okay, if there was an evolution, where did it begin? And someone said, it's Big Bang. So then you say, well, okay, where was that before the Big Bang? Well, there was nothing before the Big Bang. So if there was nothing before the Big Bang, how did everything come from nothing? How does that make sense? How can everything come from nothing? So those are the questions that we go into, right?
Yeah. And if there is a higher being, what came before that?
Exactly, right. Yeah,
the whole infinity is such a almost impossible concept for humans to imagine or rationalize because we want there to be a bound on something, and infinity doesn't give us the ability to process what's beyond because there is no beyond.
That's true.
If time is infinite and space is infinite, then everything is possible.
Yeah. Yes. Now, what I would say is that infinity and no infinity, or the opposite of infinity, whatever that may be.
Finite.
Those are finite. Yeah. Right. Those are concepts of the mind, right? In the original word for zero was actually shunya, which was in Indian philosophy, it was considered both infinity and zero in one, if that makes any sense. So, and I don't know if you're going off track here. So, but we're on the topic. So let's kind of follow this, right? There's a song that I used to sing to my kid, you know, three blue pigeons sitting on a wall, right? I don't know if you heard that. Three blue pigeons sitting on a wall, and then one flies away. How many are left? Two blue pigeons sitting on a wall. That flies away, right? One is there. That flies away. How many are left?
No blue pigeons, I guess.
No blue pigeons sitting on a wall, right? So there's zero blue pigeons sitting on a wall. But what is left when you take away the pigeons with the idea of a pigeon?
Just a wall.
Everything is left. Everything is left. So that's infinity, right? Everything is infinity. And zero is so when we talk about these concepts, they are very, very contextual. So something that is kind of very difficult to wrap our heads around for a lot of us, if you haven't really spent time doing this kind of thinking, is this idea that, you know, the world goes away when you go to sleep, right? Where did the world go when we went to sleep? So there's
our belief system is that it carries on. We just weren't aware of it. That's right. Our belief system.
So
there's no guarantee that it does,
And thank you for that, having the little that doubt, right? So the world comes into existence when this person wakes up, that person wakes up for that person, right? So the idea there is that I'm not proposing another model, although I think there is something in my mind. There's another model outside of the linear thinking and creationist Darwin. All of those things are good. They're wonderful things, right? And so the other thing that happens is that when we talk about these kinds of things, we haven't thought about this much. So what we do is we automatically go into the opposite. If it's not a creationist Darwinist theory, or if I don't believe in Darwin's theory of evolution, then I must believe in 7-day creation theory. And we have a very strong reaction to that, right? Or some other aspects, or I have to be spiritual if I...
I think it's more nuanced than having to believe in a 7-day creation theory. I think there can be intelligent design. There can be other things that create. It doesn't have to be a God definition figure. It could be a higher intelligence or a...
Yeah.
A matrix model, if you like, where
that's a wonderful model.
Simulations and
exactly
other things.
A computer game. Yeah. So anyway, so the reason why I kind of get into this is because the awareness, right? So when we have that aha moment, so the word gnosis, G-N-O-S-I-S, and the word knowledge comes from the word G-N-O-S-I-S, gnosis. And the original meaning of the word is sharing insight into the nature of things. So, you know, we have all this conditioning that we have, and we have an aha moment. And once we have an aha moment about that, whatever that is, then our mind doesn't go back to the way it was before, and we have expanded our understanding. So then that's one way to define knowledge. So knowledge can be a collection of data, right? Rewiring for our brain, the physicality of brain. Collection of data, but learning and knowledge can also be just blowing out of our existing body of knowledge and having an insight, and that's where our mind opens up. So this is how we can go beyond our filtering and biases and things like that. And this is the real growth, right? Because, you know, growth doesn't happen by just collection of data from different people, different opinion, different perspectives, right? It happens when we have our own insight into things and we say, aha. Now, that doesn't mean that it's an original thought. It doesn't mean that no one else has thought that thought before. But to me, in that moment, that's my original thought. And this is where the growth is, right? This is where what I call true learning is. And to me, this is important because this is how transformation in people happens. If I want to work with someone and I want to help them get better in some way, shape, or form, and if they are willing, then this is the faculty that helps us get there or helps us help that person get there.
So when you're working with teams in a workplace, is this a one-to-one or is this a group session? Because I would imagine that everyone's interpretation of what you've been saying, well, yeah, they'll have their own metaphor, their own sense, sure, of what that means.
And that's wonderful.
How do we align people and try and get some commonality of
that's a great
passion and purpose?
Yeah. So diversity, right? We talk about, your podcast talks about inclusion and diversity, right? And equity. So there's two contradictory ideas there, right? There's diversity, but then we have to come together and work. So we have to find some common ground, which is what you're asking, right? So what's that common ground? Well, the common ground is very easy way to describe that is, well, we're all humans. We're all human beings, right? So that's our common ground. And then the question comes, well, how do you define a human being? And that's all that conversation that we have, right? We just had thus far. So to answer your question, to me, when a team, an organization, whether you are five people, two people team, or you 100 people or 1,000 people or 100,000 people or the entire civilization,
right?
The foundation is, to me, so, well, first of all, we are all human beings. So, I think we all agree on that, right? To me, I try to access this awareness, which is a common ground. To me, that's a common ground. But so that can be a dogma. That cannot be something that, I'm not expecting Joanne to understand that or accept that. But we explore that. But we start with this idea that we're both human beings, right? So that's the commonality. Now, within that, there is the diversity. So the diversity, the funny thing is that there are 7 billion people on this planet. Not two of us even look alike, right? So we are truly, each one of us is a truly unique individual. Now, add to that our psychological conditioning, our upbringing, our belief systems, our talent. So even if you have two twin brothers or sisters, you're going to have differences, right? So they're two entirely different people. So the challenge is to find the common ground. And to me, that is awareness. And we can say, okay, fine, it's human beings. So we're all human beings. And then we need to, at the same time, celebrate the uniqueness that we bring to the table. So awareness, and then what comes out of the awareness is the celebration. That's how I look at it, right? So awareness is the ground. It doesn't change. That is the oneness that we all share. We all are aware. So, there's consciousness there, there's consciousness here. That's what we share. But the manifestation of that, the expression of that awareness is so entirely unique to each individual. And this is why I believe that perspective is our superpower, our self-awareness. And so the way we express and the way we play out in this planet is our superpower. So now when we bring it to the teams, I think the basic element is, of course, the person. That's the note. So if you were looking at Eiffel Tower, we talk about organizational structures, right? All the time, right? So if you're looking at it as a static structure, a bridge or an Eiffel Tower, you're going to have the nodes, right? And then between those nodes, there is this big beams, like iron things, right? That they connect them. So those are the relationships. So if an organizational structure is a structure like that, then you can have people and the relationship between those people. So how we talk to each other, how we converse with each other, how we work with each other, right? That, so the strength of that relationship is the strength of the organization. So the strength of the people in organization is how strong, how functional, how performative or how productive that organization could be. It's kind of an abstract thing, but I think, I don't know if that answers the question, but so that's where it comes together. Relationships, basically.
Yeah. I grasp the concept, we think about, you talk about self-awareness and, looking at yourself from above, and you can then look at the impact you're having. If you can see what's going on around you, you see all the actors and all the people taking part, yeah, you can perceive the impact you're having, positive or negative. You can,
right,
start to address your biases. You can start to address threats.
Exactly.
You can start to contextualize the environment, yeah, you're in. Whereas if you're just looking in the moment, you're blinkered, you're very shut down.
Exactly.
In a reactive mode.
Yeah.
Then you're going to be less, as you say, self-aware of what's, right, going on around you.
Right. Exactly.
It's how do you move from the awareness to action? How do you make that leap? First leap is stepping out of yourself. The next leap is being aware. And then the next leap is how to re-engage control.
Yes.
How does one do that?
Yeah. And that's going to be contextual. So for example, if you look at context, there is, okay, what is it we're trying to achieve? So there is a vision first, right? And why do we want to achieve that? So there's a why. So there's a purpose. So there's a vision and there's purpose, right? And once we have those in mind, then we can say, well, how do we get there, right? This is where we want to go. This is why we want to get there. This is my why as to why I want to get there. And then we say, well, what are some of the things that I need to do to get there? What are some of the actions that I need to take? How do we execute to get there?
So and that's where model this with comes our steps and steps, yeah, sort of. Yeah. How do we get to 5? How do we get to 6? How do we get to 10?
Exactly.
Visionary.
Yeah.
Looking at the big picture rather than the ground in front of us.
Yeah. And the big picture could be, so it depends on how big an organization is. For example, let's say you're running a 100 people organization. You're a business and you have a CEO or a founder, and there's 100 people working within that organization, and they have their reporting structure. So then we had to look at it that kind. So how does awareness come about? Or how does it become an agent to doing ABC XYZ? So the first question is, do they even want to be aware or not? It's a very basic question. So I always start with the leadership out. And I don't like to say top down, but that's another way of saying it. I like to look at, you know, there's one person. Even if there is a multiple people team, executive team, there's one person who is in a leadership position, who is the ripple effect, this is the center of this ripple effect, right? That person. And I work with that person in executive coaching. So that's one of the ways that I start. And that's actually almost always the way. But why would you want to do that? If the why isn't there, if everything is working fine, if the revenues are where they want it to be, where if the gross margins are where they want it to be, if their people are productive and happy and wonderful, they're showing up every day, they don't complain, then you don't need to talk about any of this, right? Just keep doing what you're doing. But what if your revenues aren't where they need to be, right? Your productivity is where you need to be, right? Your people are, it's like a revolving door, right? They're not staying. There's no retention. There's on and on and on, right? There's lots of problems that an organization can, and this is a healthy organization. Every organization has problems. So if you want to fix that problem, right, that's when we begin to talk about, well, what are some of the ways that we can do this? Now, what happens typically is that most people will go to, I call it the business philosophy. The business philosophy that has been handed down generation to generation to generation. And this business philosophy is where they go to. They don't find their answers there. And we're actually sort of in that, in this loop right now. I call it the dependency epidemic. Our organizations are deeply dysfunctional today. Our engagement, Gallup has done studies where they say that most people are only 33% of the people in an organization are engaged to their work, right? The other 60. So if you have 6 people team, only 2 people are engaged. The other 4 are doing. One is actually destroying the work of the others. And I think the remaining 3 are just there doing the minimum required. And if you manage a team of 6 people, you'll kind of get this. And this is normally how it plays out, right? So the question is why? So am I running a functional organization or am I running a dysfunctional organization? If you're running a dysfunctional organization, are the popular press management giving you those answers? If you are getting your answers there, then perfectly fine. Keep doing it. If not, then you need to kind of open up the mind and say, well, let me think about something else. And this is where someone like Bhavesh comes in and say, well, hey, you know, look at it this way. All right. That's when they will be open to listening to someone like me, because my proposition is that we're still using the management practices and philosophies that were developed in the industrial age, which was about 250 years ago, codified in that time, scientific management theories. But we haven't really evolved the way we manage people, the way we build organization, the way we lead people at all. We put man on the moon, you know, with this used to be a giant supercomputer just 50 years ago. Right? But we hold that in the palm of our hands. But we have done absolutely no, well, there's some. So industrial age revolution, that was an attempt on our part to say, okay, let's make our people productive, super productive. And we said, well, how do we do this? And there have been studies done. It's this guy called Frederick Taylor. He comes along and he says, well, you know, he was a machinist and we were fascinated by machines. So he saw the businesses as machines and people as machine parts. So the entire philosophy of managing people was looked on as if people are machines. And this is a flaw. We still look at our people as machines. This is why we love AI even more. I've been talking about this for 20 years. This message is even more relevant today because we love AI for this reason. Because we don't know how to manage people. We don't know how to deal with people. We don't know how to deal with differences. We don't know how to deal with people who have passion, who have talent, who have their opinions, right? Who have wisdom, who have aspirations, who have goals in life. We don't like that. We don't know how, we don't know what to do with it, right? So the existing management philosophies don't give us tools to it. So, and this is not their fault. This is not the fault of the leader. So the result is that I call it dependency epidemic. We have created deeply dependent organizations. So if the leader goes away for 3 months or 6 months, the organization begins to fall apart. So you just think about a business, right? If someone is running, I'm sure you work with business people, right? Where you have someone is running a 200 people firm. The business owner says, okay, I'm going to take a sabbatical. I'm going to go away for 6 months. And when she or he or they come back, the organization is gone, right? Most of the time, unless they've set up some structures and things like that. So going back to your question, how does self-awareness come into play in this? And that's a very important question. So once they're open to looking at this, then we can talk about how to bring in the human element, which is missing in our business. So truly finding, so all the conversation that we've had to this point, you know, looking at a human being as a human being, not as a machine, right? When we do that, we unlock the true potential of our people. We're already paying for it. Salaries are the highest on most people's P&L statements. But we're only getting 33% from that. So if I learn how to do this well, this goes into all of the things that's happening today, you know, remote work and bring them back, canceling the DEI initiatives and stuff like, because we don't know how to deal with human beings as human beings. So did I go on a rant?
Oh, as you're talking now, I'm thinking, if you think about a diverse world we live in, people have vastly different starting points on yes. the journey you're talking about.
Yeah.
And you throw into the mix someone who's neurodivergent.
Yeah. Right.
I can imagine there's a huge challenge in yeah. trying to get this alignment given the starting point. And it must be a real challenge to you to work with organizations. You may well be able to get a number of people thinking in this way, but the challenge must be the outliers who really struggle with the concept.
Yes. And the outliers, actually, the outliers are probably the majority I work with. Not everybody is open to this message. And that's true, at least today. It might be different 10 years from now or 20 years from now. But it's the only way that they can be open to it is if I bring them results. And the results have to be there. And otherwise, commitment won't be there, right? So for me to sell this, quote unquote, sell this to the organizations, I need to bring the results and sometimes fairly immediate results. And then when we're talking, and I'm not saying a week or month or something like that, 3 months, 6 months, you know, there's some results. And then they get a little bit sold, and then we can do a long-term. Ultimately, this is a long-term commitment type of thing, right? It's a long-term, 1 year, 2 year, something like that. Mm. But it can happen.
The other thing that's occurring to me as you're talking is we almost need to be able to step out, not just of ourselves, but also ourselves as part of a team or ourselves as part of a business. I need to be able to look at how my team is performing.
Exactly.
How my business is performing.
Yeah.
It's that shifting your focus from self to team to division to organization.
Yes.
And being self-aware of all of those layers as well.
Absolutely.
That must be the challenge.
Absolutely. Well, the measurements that we use, I mean, we actually do it, you know, we call it objectification, right? Objective, so KPR and all those things. That brings an element of awareness. It's a very narrow view of that awareness, but it does. So, but what this requires is more of a open awareness on the part of the leadership. It starts there. If they don't get bought into this, then it absolutely doesn't work, Right. So it's a transformation that starts from the top down or inside up. If the person who is the leader, who is in the center of the organization, and if you look at it as like a ripple effect. So it has to work from the leadership team. They have to commit to it. They have to be to be open to this idea and then willing to give it a try. So then, you know, in those experiments, in those pilots, you kind of say, well, these are the things that we're going to shoot for. You know, what are you looking for? Why are we doing this? And they'll find a 3-month thing where you can see tangible results. Now, the tangible results may be measurable, but sometimes they're not. Now, anything can be measured, right? But sometimes it's an intuitive feeling. Most leaders are actually intuitive, right? And they'll know that, okay, my team is functioning better, right? Now, the problem is when you have a hierarchy where you have a vice president who is reporting to a president and CEO, and he needs to prove to their superiors that, you know, whatever it is that he's taking on is working, and then they have to prove it to someone. But if you're working, and I work with basically folks who are self-contained entities where there is a definitive person who is at the helm, right? And this person doesn't have to report to anyone except their family, So they are, so that's where I come in. And that is where my bread and butter is, because organizations, it can happen. I work with organizations and within the pockets. So within organizations, there is sometimes someone who is in charge of P&L within the large organization, and they have that sort of self-contained team. I've done some work with them, but they are always accountable to someone. So, but even in those cases, anything can be measured. Productivity can be measured. Even happiness can be measured. So, but you just have to find out what those measurement metrics are.
Yeah, I'm with you on most of this. I'm just trying to think about, I'm definitely a possibilist to start with. Uh-huh. Yeah, anything's possible. Yeah. And then I move into implementation and all the risk analysis and resistance and objection handling. So one outlier is going to, I'm not saying it would disrupt the whole process, but it would make the communication channels between team members and the business more tricky, wouldn't it? Where people aren't wholly bought into this. So it really has got to, you've got to embrace this as a team.
Now, so this is where it becomes important to make sure that it's not seen as some kind of a cultism thingy that's come being forced down from the top, right? They have to buy into this. So for that, there is a very simple way. So you don't have to talk about any of these things. So there are sometimes when I would sit down with someone who's a leader, and I would say, do this. And there's a process that begins with one-on-one. So if you're a leader, let's say you have 100 people company, you have 5 people who are reporting to you, who is the executive team, right? And you want to kind of give this a shot. All I would ask you to do is have a one-on-one conversation with each one of these people. And don't talk about any of this stuff that we talked about, because it may just scare them away, right? But ask them some 3 or 4 very simple questions, right? And I don't know how much time we have right now, but I would ask them to take a sheet of paper like that and write down at the top of my job, right? My job here with this organization. And ask the first question, why, right? Halfway down that sheet of paper is what. On the back of the sheet, you write how and how, right? So if I'm a manager or you're a manager, you would sit down with this person and say, well, why is this job important to you? So this becomes part of the management process. It can also become part of the recruitment process. These are powerful questions to ask, right? Why work here? So they'll come up with 1 through 3 things. Right? What's your vision working here, right? Fast forward 2, 3, 4, 5 years down the road, where do you see yourself in context of working here? And then on the flip side, how do we get there? So this process, we can do another podcast just on this, but this process brings together everything that we've talked about. And it's a simple enough process. So the idea there is that when they say why, when they answer the question, why am I working here? They are basically giving you the reason that that's their engagement. Right? Organizations don't have this conversation. Why are you here? We've done incredible volume of data analysis and things like that. And we do job performance and stuff like that, but they don't ask these basic questions. Why this job? Why are you here? And this question needs to be visited again and again and again, not because like a challenge or anything like that, but share with me why it's important for you to work here so that I understand you. There are some guidelines. You know, you don't misuse this, right? So, but there is, so it's, you know, we talked about this, right? The structure is a relationship between the two people. This is how it happens, right? You ask the why question, why you're here. And then what's the vision? There needs to be some understanding, some empathy. All of these things come into play, right? Understanding the other person, not jumping and telling them why they need to be there, right? You're listening and you're asking the question, why are you here? And they're telling you, you're listening, you write it down, you have them write it down, right? Whatever because you can't argue with their why, right? So, and then they tell you what is their vision of being there. And they say, well, I want to be making $150,000 a year, 2 years down the road. Now that vision you need to basically agree on. If someone is saying, well, I'm going to be making $300,000, and you might say, well, this job is not going to get you there. It'll get you to maybe $200,000. So it's this kind of a conversation that needs to happen between the boss and the employee to have that bond. And then the idea is that the manager, the supervisor, the leader becomes a resource to that person, right, at one level. And then, so it's like, I think you mentioned, it's almost like being a coach, right? You are in a coaching relationship just as well, as much as you are also a leader or a manager who's responsible for this person to do what they need to do. But yeah, you become a resource, you become a mentor, you become all of those things or some of those things. But that's it. So the understanding and empathy and, you know, really getting to know someone and what makes them tick. And also being very ethical about it, because you can't be talking about to all these people and you can't play politics based on what someone tells you. Because if you do that, then that breaks the trust, right? And then they won't open up, or they'll give you the wrong answer. They'll give you the answers that you want to hear. Yeah. But so my point is that this comes down to nuts and bolts. And I've done presentations on how this little process ties into a lot of the things that we talked about, right? Because there is a co-relationship. So, you know, there's intricacies of how asking these simple questions actually taps into a lot of the things that we talked about. And being aware here, right? So you bring awareness to, that's always a play. That's always in play, right? You are being aware of the conversation. When you're aware, you will notice things in people that you normally would not notice if you weren't aware.
Yeah.
You'll be able to understand them better.
Yeah, that's a critical part. When I'm trying to, my brain's going back to things like emotional intelligence and the whole point of self-awareness and self-management, self-regulation is to be more aware of your surroundings as well. And the cues you're picking up from people, be aware of your breathing, your biases, whatever it may be.
Right, right.
And so once you become aware of self, you become more tuned in and aware of others.
Absolutely.
And then you can regulate and adjust and be more person-centric, can't you?
That's a great point. Yeah, excellent point. Yeah, exactly. So the degree to which we are self-awareness is a degree to which we are able to help others get in touch with their own self-awareness. And there is this connection, this understanding, the deep understanding that we normally don't see in business relationships.
Because leadership is sort of social influence, and being aware of self and how you're interacting with somebody else gives you, I was going to say, great power, great insight into having productive conversations, productive outcomes, and persuasion, whatever it may be.
Right, right.
By creating that alignment. And that starts with self-awareness and aware of others, isn't it?
Exactly.
Constantly course correct, so you're not crashing into each other.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. Great. That's a great point. Yeah.
I think I get it.
Good. All right. Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah,
so I've been trying to play with everything you're saying and trying to contextualize it into my metaphors and view of the world. And I think I'm getting what you're saying here. It's trying to create that alignment and that interfacing with other people.
Yeah.
Starting with who are we?
Right.
And then who are you?
Yeah.
And how do we want to communicate, and how do we become more effective?
Right. Yes. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for playing with me on that. So, because these are different things that people to talk about in a business conversation that most people are are accustomed to. So
I mean, I talk to a lot of people about emotional intelligence, and to many people, it's a dark art just talking about it, and even getting people to be accountable for for their persona.
It's like,
I'm just me. I don't care. I don't care what you think of me. I'm just me. Well, actually, if you start caring about what people think of you, it's not necessarily to worry about judgment or worry about the negative side, but just aware. Because if you think you're A and people think you're B, then you need to shift perspectives. You
exactly.
Need to say, well, hang on a minute. If no matter how I'm thinking, you believe I'm like this, and go, hang on a minute. Why is there a disconnect between who I think I am and who you think I am?
Right. Yeah.
And if there's a misalignment there, you have the power of change, don't you?
Exactly. Yes. Yeah, you do. And I want to throw out another term. Emotional intelligence is a good term. And there's a very specific definition of what that means. Mm. I like the term emotional awareness because it's a very simple term. It's self-explanatory. It's awareness of how you're feeling. So one of the the seven dimensions of awareness is one of those seven dimensions is awareness of how I'm feeling in this moment. So that's a very powerful thing to be, right? So, and emotional intelligence to me is, it implies it may not be meant that way, but sometimes it's interpreted as using intellect to overpower the emotion. And that's somehow, and that's not good because that is a suppression of emotion. Suppression of emotion is not healthy. So I like the term emotional awareness in the sense that, okay, what am I feeling this morning in this moment? So right now we're having this conversation. So I am in a nice, optimistic, happy state right now because I enjoy having this kinds of conversation, right? And so that's my feeling right now. Now I may be sitting down, having a cup of coffee, and I may be tired a little bit. Moment to moment being aware of how I'm feeling, that brings us a tremendous amount of power to own that feeling, number one. And then if there's something needs to be done about that, then we can do that.
Yeah. So I think I like that differentiation. And I see what you're saying about, because I always get worried that we talk about, the four pillars, if you like, of emotional intelligence.
Yeah.
The self-awareness and the self-regulation. It's almost, as you say, it's almost trying to override your natural flow state.
Exactly.
And force yourself into a different zone.
Yes.
Rather than just being hyper aware and in that moment.
Yes.
And realizing you're maybe standing in the wrong place. I think also if you recognize that humans store a lot of memories with their emotions and how they're feeling, you kind of regress back in time to a place where you were happy.
Right.
Can change your whole persona, can't it? Bringing yourself in that conscious state.
Clear. Yeah. I would, one example I'd like to give is, imagine Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s speech, I have a dream. If he was being emotionally intelligent, he would kind of regulate those emotions and he'll say, now I have a dream, right? He'll say, I kind of have this dream, but I'm not sure if I'll be able to attain it or not. Who knows? Right? That's being emotionally intelligent, right? But there's no doubt. There is no hesitation. That's emotional awareness, right? So emotions are very powerful and they have a purpose. There is a reason for those emotions. And some of these emotions are wonderful because, it brings us together. It allows us to do things that we have never done before. And so one of the things that we've done with some conversation we had about viewing people as machine parts is that we don't like people emoting in the workplace, right? So, and because we don't know what to do with it. Right. So this is why we love emotional intelligence so much, because it can be used as a way to tell people, hey, be emotionally intelligent. Don't let it all hang out. Right. Oh, and I'm starting to see that term in job descriptions. You require emotional intelligence to work here. And then that can be taken in so many different ways. We are so dysfunctional and we are so toxic that you'll need to be emotionally intelligent to work here. Otherwise you'll fall apart. So, but that's my cynical take on.
I suppose I would interpret it as you want people to be accountable.
Yes, that's
for
true.
For their impact, accountable for their intent that goes bad. I mean, that's how I would describe it.
That's true.
I wake up believing I'm doing a good job. I believe I'm a good person.
Yeah.
But someone else has a different belief. So the impact that's had has been negative.
Right.
And I just have to be accountable for that. Either I reflect and go, actually, you're right. Or I reflect and go, no, I'm comfortable with what I did and I'll stand by that.
Right.
So I think some of it is just having a that, I think you go back to what the language you use, self-awareness, self-reflection, and just that appreciation of self, whether that's the helicopter view.
Right.
How do I come across? Am I a dick or am I a nice person?
Right.
I want to be a nice person.
Right.
If I'm coming across as a dick,
yeah,
it's my, I got the power to change, haven't I?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So as soon as you're aware, you have the power. Exactly. Exactly what you said. Yeah. You know, once you're aware, then you have the power. But if I'm suppressing it, then I'm suppressing it. And then I'm denying that I even have that feeling. And then if you don't accept that there is an issue, then you won't fix it. So then you'll continue to behave in that way.
Yeah. And you have the choice, you know, to change. And if you...
Exactly. Right.
If someone points out to you the fact that remark was racist, that remark was whatever,
yeah,
and you go, I don't care, well, that's your choice.
Yeah.
You have the choice to change. Telling someone to change is not what you're trying to do. You're trying to create a gravitational attraction to change being positive, aren't you? So show, don't tell.
Yeah. Yeah. And there are patterns that we play out. There are certain belief patterns that come to the surface in awareness. So for example, if I have certain views about certain race of people or certain shape of people, and they are hidden. There is nothing wrong with it. We all have flaws, right? We might have some experience with a parental figure who was short and that person wasn't nice to me. So then I have maybe been holding some grievances about people who are short, right? So then I may react to them in a certain way. But if I'm aware of my patterns, my emotions, my thoughts while I'm interacting with people, then I would over time begin to see that, hey, there is a pattern. You know, I don't like short people, right? So then if nothing else, you will be able to course correct and you will be able to say, well, okay, you know, I need to be aware of the fact that I have this issue. So, you know, may play out because these things are as long as these things are subconscious, we have no power, exactly what you said. But once they come into our awareness, then we have the power to change our behavior and ultimately even change that pattern. That takes some work sometimes, but we can at least change our behavior.
It's been an absolutely fascinating conversation. And you're right, we could dive even deeper into this and spend many, many more hours going into this. And I've really enjoyed it. So how can people get hold of you, you know, if they want to find out more?
Sure. The best way to get hold of me is my website, which is awayre.com. And I spell it out because the pronunciation of that name is actually aware, but it's spelled with a Y, right? It's awayre.com. The best thing that I ask folks to do is go to the top right and click the Start Here button. And that gives you some assessments and some, this all free stuff. That allow you to ask some questions or answer some questions, and it gives you some reports and things like that. So,
yes, yeah.
And then you can from there you can get my email, my LinkedIn. I'm on LinkedIn a lot.
Yeah, I've been on your website before, and there's quite a lot of video content on there as well, isn't there? And
that's true.
Interviews you've done, and yeah, there's some good stuff on there. So, not just the interactive stuff, but yeah, you can consume more of your ideas on the videos, I think.
Yes, I've done some videos on some of the things that we're talking about today. I also have a podcast, which is called The Business Philosopher with the New Podcast. And on that podcast, I have people who have built successful organizations. Yeah, and some of the leaders we talked about today, you know, they fit in that category. Really great people that I've interviewed, including Joanne.
Little old me. Yeah, and I was a guest a couple of weeks ago.
You were a guest a couple of weeks ago. So, So we have had some great conversations on that. Encourage you to check it out, the podcast.
Yeah, excellent. Well, I'll put all those details in the show notes. So I'm sure people will get in contact with you, and I'll make sure your LinkedIn profile is there because, as you say, it's a place you hang out a lot. So do I. So, no doubt we'll bump into each other again there very soon.
Sure. Sounds great. Thank you so much. Thanks for having me on your podcast, Joanne. And this was a great conversation.
Bhavesh, thank you.
Enjoyed it.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks.
As we bring this conversation to a close, I want to express my deepest gratitude to you, our listener, for lending your ear and heart to the cause of inclusion. Today's discussion struck a chord. Consider subscribing to Inclusion Bites and become part of our ever-growing community, driving real change. Share this journey with friends, family, and colleagues. Let's amplify the voices that matter. Got thoughts? stories, or a vision to share, I'm all ears. Reach out to joe.lockwood@seachangehappen.co.uk and let's make your voice heard. Until next time, this is Joanne Lockwood, signing off with a promise to return with more enriching narratives that challenge, inspire, and unite us all. Here's to fostering a more inclusive world, one episode at a time. Catch you on the next bite.